Special Committee on Oil and Gas, 6:02 PM on Tuesday, the 31st of January, already at the end of the month. Hard to believe that we're almost a fourth of the way through the legislative session, but here we are. I'm Vic Coring, I chair the committee, and with us we have Nancy Dahlstrom, we've got Norm Rockwood, we've got Ralph Samuels, and I think we're going to have Roberta Gardner soon, and, but anyway, we have got enough to field a quorum here. I'm going to, with the concurrence of my friends from the Oil and Gas Association, I'd like to ask that we just take perhaps 10 minutes or so to address House Bill 294, and that's Chenault's bill that he can't present himself because he's got a family situation, of course, so we're grateful for the presence of his staff aide, Sue Wright, so we'll have Sue step forward just to, if you want to make some just quick remarks on the legislation, address some of the concerns that we brought forth during the last committee hearing, and then I'll take it up for consideration of the committee as far as their intentions, so Sue Wright.
Hi, for the record, I'm Sue Wright, and first of all, I would like to thank all the committee members for being able to come back and present this bill again. I have actually nothing more to add. I think we've talked about it, and I have, I do believe behind me, some folks that are much more expert at this than I am, and if you have questions, they're ready and available.
I have a question, I don't really want to put you on the spot, and you can please feel comfortable or at ease to defer this to the folks at Marathon who have an interest in this particular bill, but that is, and forgive me, Representative Samuels, if I'm taking one of your questions here, and you're welcome to add to this, but I, you brought a very good point up during our conversation a short while ago, and that is how did we derive those numbers as far as the percentages and so forth, the 25% and the 50% and so forth in the legislation? Was there a reason that justified those particular numbers, or were they just hypothetically chosen, or do you have an answer on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's John Barnes, Marathon Oil, and hypothetically chosen is probably an accurate point. They were designed to be a starting point for discussion. Recognizing, of course, Department of Revenue and others will have to take a view through some type of modeling effort to understand and provide the legislature with tools to try to calibrate the amount of incentive that they would seek.
Even if it were hypothetical, I thought the chart that you presented me, which may or may not be in the file here, but you projected some numbers through your graph and your chart, here it is, that demonstrated that even though the state would be giving up a pretty good chunk of money, the net return over time would be pretty substantial. You're looking at like a 4-to-1 ratio for every dollar that we would give up in extra taxes that we would grant you in the form of a credit, we would generate $3 in revenue. So I like the way those charts looked, assuming those numbers were close to being accurate.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman. I would agree that there is a return. The state needs to try to understand what ratio they want to shoot for. And obviously, there's many assumptions, gas price, cost to develop. Those, again, the chart's meant to be a talking point, a very, very simple model to try to, again, be a starting point in a dialogue towards the state calibrating some type of incentive. Mm-hmm.
And also be mindful, I don't mean to dominate the conversation, but be mindful this committee does have subsequent referrals to it. So if the members of the body here felt that, the legislative body as a whole, that has felt that after thinking it through more or through additional information, that those numbers need to be adjusted in some way, they can always do that. But I myself at this point feel comfortable with those numbers, albeit somewhat on the high side, at least of the opinion of some of the members of the committee. Are there any other questions of the committee? Ralph, do you have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chairman. I spoke with Marathon earlier today and had the same types of questions, and we'll try to get with revenue when we get to resources and get some of those things hammered out, and I'll work with them. I know Representative Rockwood had a question also, which if we don't get addressed here, we'll make sure we address in the first hearing in the next committee also.
Representative Rockwood, you care to address your question now?
Well, I have a question, but not necessarily Mr. Barnes. Just has to do with the applicability of the credit to projects below 68 degrees north latitude.
Good one.
And I want to thank the committee aides for bringing a copy of the statute to our attention. I have a conceptual amendment that I might be able to offer at that time. Is there, if there's anybody that who cared to discuss it, whether it would be is regarding, Mr. Chairman, is prohibiting the delivery of ANS gas south of the 68-degree north latitude.
Frank, that was a concern of mine as well that we addressed during the last committee, and I appreciate you bringing this up.
It's a conceptual amendment, and I think it'd be appropriate. And particularly, not that I necessarily agree with it, but in light of everything else that's going on in this legislative session, I think it would help expedite this bill and not get it commingled with other legislation that may be before this legislature.
Okay. You're welcome to offer that amendment and speak to it.
Is there any other testimony you want to take?
No. We had our public testimony during the last hearing. We've since closed the testimony.
I would ask Mr. Barnes then one question.
Okay.
Mr. Barnes, if I offered an amendment that would prohibit the use of the credit below the 68th parallel, would you have any objections to that?
Representative Rookberg.
For ANS gas only?
Okay. That's a good insight.
Yeah, right.
I believe that's consistent with the original intent of the bill. I'm not a lawyer, so I think people smarter than I am can get the wording right.
Well, that's why it's conceptual. I'm not either. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And if you wish, I'd be prepared to make an amendment.
Okay. Before you do that, I just wanted to clarify where that is in geographical terms. It's basically the Brooks Range and everything. South of the Brooks Range would be excluded in this, would be included in this legislation. North would not be. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. However, I think your concern relates to, what happens if we build a gas line and additional infrastructure like a LNP plant or whatever. We want to make sure that this bill doesn't apply to that. Is that correct?
Well, yeah, that's why, Mr. Chairman, I believe it's in the subsection F of the statute, which is before us. AS 4320043, subsection F, little f.
What page is that on, please?
Well, it's not. It's in the statute that was distributed by your committee.
I got that.
From Ms. Wright.
Yes, I've got that.
If you look at that in the middle of the page there, the F section.
I see it.
At the end of the sentence, it says, located in the area of Alaska lying north of 68 degrees north latitude. You delete the period and add the following words, or for the delivery of Alaska North Slope natural gas to tidewater below 68 degrees north latitude, period. And that is in the form of, I move that in the form of conceptual amendment number one.
All right. Any objections to that conceptual amendment as are noted by Representative Rookberg? Seeing none, it's adopted.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Any further discussion on either that amendment or the legislation before us? If not, what is the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I move House Bill 294 as amended with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
We have a motion before us, as noted, to pass House Bill 294 with accompanying fiscal note and individual recommendations. Any objections to moving the bill? Seeing none, House Bill 294 is moved out of committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Okay, next is the presentation by our friends from AOGA. So we'll call Judy Brady for us to initiate the presentation. Welcome, Judy. Good to have you here again. This is becoming a tradition. I think this is about the fourth presentation you've made before the committee since I've been chair.
Thanks,
I appreciate your efforts.
We appreciate you being asked, and thank you for committee members for staying so late to hear about the committee.
And likewise, same to you.
I'd like to, we have some very interesting people that are going to help with this presentation today. In fact, I think you'll be very pleased. Randall Buckendorf is a senior attorney for BP, and he is the going to be working on the Liberty Project. Mark Major has been 30 years with ConocoPhillips, and he is the senior environmental and regulatory manager for the Alpine and Alpine satellites. Pat Foley, Pioneer, who's the land commercial and regulatory affairs manager, and he is working on the GERC project. So three of the hot new projects on the North Slope, we have the people who are the key permitters and regulators here. So if gentlemen who join us up here, what we're going to do, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, is we're going to each do a piece, and then any one of us can break in.
Okay.
and add the perspective, because the perspective is different. This is a North Slope permitting discussion.
Mm-hmm.
If we were doing Cook Inlet as well, which I hope you will give us the opportunity to do, you would have different issues. You would have some different issues.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Welcome, gentlemen. Good to have you here.
By the way, we were laughing because when we were talking about it, because all three of these regulators and environmental permitters once worked for ARCO.
Oh.
And some of them never had to leave the office to not be working for ARCO.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, is that the company formerly known as Alaska Richfield?
Something like that. Atlantic Richfield, yes.
Yes.
All right. The first, we're going to start with a simple overview, a quick overview. We're going to try to take less than an hour. You'll see in the middle here we have some questions we're asking, and we're going to end with those questions, and the regulators the permitters for the different projects are going to try to answer those questions. Mr. Chairman, if people have questions at mm-hmm. any time during the presentation, feel free to ask
Great.
Those questions.
Thank you. We will.
The question we always are asked is, can oil and gas development coexist with effective protection of sensitive environments? And this is the whole background. This is the whole context of permitting, because permitting is essentially mitigation. That would be a yes. The interesting thing about this question is that the first picture is doctored. We took out the oil well, this is the real picture here. And everybody is pretty well aware that the Central Arctic caribou herd went from 5,000 animals to over 35,000 animals during the 40 years, and as now, during the 40 years of oil and gas.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is that all of the oil and gas produced in Alaska is produced in sensitive environments. Those of you who've been on the North Slope a number of times will notice that the picture on the left is exactly what the North Slope looks like in the summertime. And there is a toolbox for oil and gas development for sensitive areas in Arctic Alaska. It's been developed over the years. You have to have a good environmental reputation. If you don't, your neighbors are not going to want you there. The agencies are not going to want you there, and the Alaska public is not going to want you there. And the industry in Alaska, we believe, in fact, we pull for this quite often, has an excellent environmental reputation. It's one of the reasons that even under a Democratic administration nationally, they were able to reopen NPRA. Because of the reputation the companies have on the North Slope. All the other things you see in here, the fishery studies, the coil tubing, the habitat mapping, the remote sensing, all the performance accountability, all of these things are a study in themselves and a speech in themselves, but they all add up to being able to operate in the Arctic. Over and over again, the Alaska Arctic is probably the most studied Arctic area in the world. Well, in fact, we know that it is. We have 40 years of studies in all these areas, constant studies on water quality, volume, fish, habitat mapping, caribou studies, subsistence studies, vegetation studies. Vegetation studies, by the way, help tell us about air quality. This is what's done before anybody goes into a project, habitat mapping. We know, the companies know where all the nesting colonies are of the various species, whether they're endangered or not, and they build their roads and their gravel pads around the nesting areas. This has been going on for years and years and years. This is putting it to work. This is ConocoPhillips, Colville River going under the Colville pipeline. Amazing, amazing feat. When engineers look at this, they fall in love all over again. This is winter seismic. Many of you have seen this. It used to be that when you were on the tundra, you could leave brown marks for 5 to 7 years. It would take that much to come back. Now it's less than 3 years, sometimes less than a year. There's zero tolerance now for seismic marks. Ice road access has been going on for some time. It takes about 1 million gallons of water a mile. You say that when you're giving this presentation in the southern states, and they all pass out. But actually, the water is percolated back down and through again, and it's about $1 million a mile. This is a winter drilling rig. This is what it looks like in the summer. And the brown marks you see there are not oil. That's just simply shadows from the way the sun is hitting the wet tundra. That's amazing, by the way. This is, you'll see that the foot, that the pipe is raised on the slope anywhere from 5 feet to 7 or 8 feet, sometimes 14 feet. And the marks you see here are not snow machine marks or anything like that. It's caribou trails. It's a caribou crossing. The permitting on Alaska's North Slope is an Arctic environment. Most of the North Slope is wetlands, which means you have to have federal permits, whether it's on state land or federal land. It's all inside the North Slope Borough. The majority of development has been on state lands inside the North Slope Borough. And recently, onshore development has moved to the federal lands NPRA. Some leases are on Arctic Slope Native Corporation lands. That's fairly new. And the offshore development involves both state and federal lands. Key approvals are environmental assessment, environmental impact, wetlands, North Slope Borough land management regulations, which are being reworked right as we speak, Alaska Coastal Management Program consistency determination, which for the North Slope Borough are being reworked as we speak, Natural Resources Department of Environmental Conservation, air and sea plans, both absolutely essential. These are the questions that oil companies want to know. How long does it take to permit? How much does it cost? Is there a transparent system? How complicated is the permitting system? How subjective is the permitting system? What are the major issues? Who should I talk to? What permits do I need? And we're going to end this with these three gentlemen responding to those questions. And we're going to turn this over now to Randall for a really complicated part.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It is a pleasure to be back in this committee with you again. Mm-hmm. And it is the fourth time I've had the privilege of speaking on this subject or an iteration or two of this same subject. And maybe part of the complexity of permitting in Alaska is evidenced by the fact that an attorney has been doing this for the past 7 years. Why is the Alaska regulatory regime so complex? It's a question we're asked all the time, and a lot of it is because of that first bullet. Multiple agency jurisdictions. We have federal, state, and local jurisdiction, local authority, everywhere we operate in the state. Dozens and dozens of permits. I have a 50-page memorandum that I walk through with our permitters for every project we look at, and that's just the state permits that we need to analyze to see if they apply to our project. Just the U.S. environmental legal structure, it's very prescriptive. It says thou shalt do A, B, and C instead of performance-driven. Some of the new environmental impact statements in NPRA have tried to be performance-driven, where it says, you know, develop your operation to be protective instead of, you know, saying, you know, setbacks of X feet. So that is a movement in recent years. Differing levels of information for every permit is needed. And multiple public comment periods. We try to work with all of the agencies where we can to overlap those public comment periods, both from the agency perspective, workload perspective, the company's perspective, and importantly because of the public who have to follow dozens and dozens of permits. And if we can get everybody in one location and talk about all of the permits and authorizations needed, it's easier on them. Recent state of Alaska permitting reforms, and Mr. Chairman, you were involved in a number of these yourself. The Alaska Coastal Management Program, I'll visit with, or I'll go through a few slides in a little bit more detail, but that is one program that just in the past few years, the legislature, through HB 191 in 2003, led through a series of reform, and it's working very well. We're happy to report back on that. A couple of things, the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation, ACMP is a process. It puts you, if you are working at developing a project in the coastal zone, it mandates a process. And The DEC permits didn't work well within that process. So in 2003, those were carved out of that, and that's working very well. Coastal districts, they can only draft enforceable policies that reflect matters of local concern now and not duplicate matters that are already regulated by state and federal law and regulation. The state is currently in the process, just received final federal approval of its of the statutory changes and its regulatory changes, and in the next 6 to 9 months we'll be approving all of the local district programs statewide. It's going to be a very busy year for that program. Two other programs that the legislature has worked to improve just in the past year on state primacy, water discharge permitting, NPDES permitting. SB 110 last year directed the Department of Environmental Conservation to go out and try and seek primacy for that program, which will be the first time they've tried to do that in the 36 years now it's been up and running at the federal level. And then underground injection control wells. The state has primacy over certain of those wells, the oil and gas wells, and SB 103 last year directed the AOGCC to work with EPA to try and assume primacy of that program.
Randall, if I could interrupt, one of the things that we are concerned about and the jury is still out on is how the coastal enforceable policies are actually going to work. The North Slope Borough is just going through their final, they're going to vote, I think, next
February 7th.
February 7th on theirs, and Kenai is voting on theirs, and there's still some concern that they're doing a lot of repeat, a lot of following of repeating regulations that are already on the book, books. And so the question is going to be, how will the Department of Natural Resources rule on whether or not it meets the statute? So the rubber meets the road right on the enforceable policies. Mm-hmm. So that's what everybody's waiting to see, is how that comes out.
Okay. Is there anything that we can do statutorily? I'll ask my question after Representative Roper. Representative Roper, and then
Mr. Chairman, I was going to just inquire what the status is of obtaining primacy on the NPDES permit system.
The status of both of those, NPDES, the state of Alaska, DEC is currently in the process of drafting its a program review and regulations. I anticipate them to be out for public review and comment in just the next few months. As far in the underground injection control well, I just spoke with Commissioner Norman about a month ago. He's been having meetings with EPA to try and overcome some of the legal hurdles that the federal government sees for handing primacy of just a partial one portion of that program to the state. They anticipate maybe not being able to get everything they want, but they're trying to work it out.
Thank you. Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You said the ACMP is going to vote internally on the 7th of February?
No, the North Slope Borough Assembly will be voting on their coastal management program on February 7th.
And the next step then?
The next step is to turn that in to the DNR. That has to be done by March 1st or February 28th, 29th, end of the month, basically.
Does DNR have a deadline to?
They do. They have a statutory deadline for approval, and the process that DNR is going to follow is they'll look at it and review those and make a determination policy by policy, not just this stack meets it, but they'll look at it on a policy by policy basis and make a determination. And then they will put those out for public review and comment to the general public and take comment on those prior to final approval or disapproval.
Thank you.
Just briefly, two types of legal requirements that are in the statute in this arena. There's those that just mandate a process. They're procedural. The first one is federal only, and that's the National Environmental Policy Act. That's what usually requires the environmental impact statement or the environmental assessment. If we just had state permits, we wouldn't have to go through that. But because we have so much federal land, and most of that federal land, over half of it, is classified by the Corps of Engineers as a jurisdictional wetland, you're pushed into getting a federal permit. So that process kicks you into a very lengthy permitting timeline. The Coastal Zone Management Act fits into that procedural process-oriented type of program. And then on the other side are the more typical substantive, your water permits, your air permits, and water use. Major federal programs, I won't go through these in any detail. We know it, the hour's late and we have a lot of presentations to go through, but this is just an example of the number of authorizations you need for most of our projects, dozens and dozens of permits.
And these are on state lands as well, just because of the wetland situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. The federally delegated or approved programs, the state, as we talked about for NPDES, the state is also able to assume primacy or directed to assume primacy in some instances of some of the federal programs. Air permitting is one of those, underground injection control. Coastal zone management is actually federally dictated. The state does not have to have a program, but if you develop it, federal government has to approve it. And then the Alaska Water Quality Standards, the standards themselves have long had to go to EPA for approval. And what they're doing right now is applying or developing a program to apply for approval of the permitting process by which those water quality standards are implemented. Multiple state agencies, most of these have dozens and dozens of authorizations from DEC, DNR, AOGCC, all the way through Fish and Game and the State Historic Preservation Office. Alaska Coastal Management Program, as I mentioned, HB 191 has helped. It's been a very busy 3 years since HB 191. We've had I don't know how many dozens and dozens of meetings at AOGA reviewing probably thousands of pages over the last 3 years. It's basically a mechanism to develop in the coastal area, and every known oil and gas resource right now in the state is considered in the coastal zone, so it's very important to our industry. It is also used to provide state input into outer continental shelf activities, which is something I'm working on right now in Liberty. And then the last bullet there is the importance of what I'll go through in the next slide, and that's the A and B list. It's a list that the state itself has developed that allows an applicant to streamline the process, and HB 191 mandated an expansion of that. The ABC list, it's a list with federal and state permits. Without this list, every time we went for a permit, we would have to go through the coastal zone management process. But what the ABC list does is allow the A list, those determinations have already been determined as categorically consistent. If you get the permit, you're already predetermined consistent with the Coastal Zone Management Act. The B list, those are general concurrence determinations. It's activities. You may get three or four different permits for a type of activity, and it's stuff that we do quite often. We do it well. And that list is being expanded. If you do the same thing, as Judy likes to say, if you're building the same box in the same location year after year, do you have to go through the same process? What the B list allows you to do is to go through it one time, develop a standard list of stipulations that apply at that time and any point in the future. A-list examples, I won't go through this in detail, but this just provides an example. If this process didn't apply, even if we were to want to put gravel on an existing pad on the north slope without expanding that, we would have to go through a coastal zone consistency review. What the A-list allows us to do is for dozens and dozens of permitted activities to basically skip that process. The B-list is the same, and this is just, we've provided a dozen examples of, there's more than 50 of them, that allow us to do that, build the same box year after year using the same standard stipulations, and it has effectively allowed us to cut days and weeks off the permitting process.
When you hear Ken Boyd talking about area-wide permitting, he's talking mainly about the B list. The big piece that's missing off the B list is a winter exploration well. Mm. We have done hundreds and hundreds of winter exploration wells, and yet because they're not on the B list, because when the state a few years ago tried to update the B list, all of the agencies went into deadlock So a winter well has to go through a consistency determination every single time, just like you never did one before. So
local programs, most of the local areas throughout the state have Alaska Title 29 Planning and Zoning Authority. Those that do are allowed to develop their own code that dictates planning zoning ordinance. There's two primary ways that both the Kenai Peninsula Borough and the North Slope Borough direct oil and gas development: through Title 29 authority and through the coastal zone management process. In the North Slope Borough example, both of those processes are currently under review. Along with their new coastal zone management policies, they're also developing new planning and zoning regulations, and those will also be approved in the next month. And
we'll see how that goes. I'm not so sure that one's going to move as fast.
That's the anticipated time frame. Another example of the process we have to go through is that, for example, the North Slope Borough, most of the area is zoned conservation. So even though we have, we're given a state or a federal lease that allows us to go out and do certain activities to explore for oil and gas and to potentially develop that oil and gas, we have to go to the North Slope Borough with a master plan and asked for that area to be rezoned for oil and gas development instead of from conservation. And we do that in every major development.
Even though it's state land?
State land, federal land, private land? Mm-hmm. You still go through the rezoning. Mm-hmm.
The permitting new resource development projects, I mean, there's identification of permits required, dozens to dozens. We're just now, BP is developing a list of our permitting plan for the Liberty project. And as I mentioned, I put together a 50-page memo just to analyze the state permits. It's very detailed because of the overlapping jurisdiction.
Could you provide that for us as a committee as to what all those permits are that you're required to have to obtain?
I'd be happy to do that. It's very broad. I recently, about 6 months ago, taught a continuing education to a bunch of local lawyers in Alaska and walked them through the same thing.
And that question parlays into my primary question, and that is your observation that there's literally dozens of authorizations that you have to obtain. Is there any of those authorizations that you feel are duplicative or redundant or unnecessary that we could perhaps take a look at? And if you can't answer that now, at least consider that a question that I'd appreciate an answer from, as far as how we can help the legislature to help streamline the process to eliminate the numbers of permits that are required, so long as it's not compromising the environment and it's not contradicting federal law.
I might just mention that CPQ that was on the other one, that's a coastal project questionnaire. We'll talk more about that a little later.
Okay.
Here's just an example of some permitting timeframes, and then the three of us will walk through large projects and how those were taken through the process and the time frame each of them went through. You know, small projects, 2 to 4 weeks, medium projects, 3 to 6 months, large projects, 3 months to greater than 3 years. The first project I worked on when I came to the state of Alaska was the Kensington Mine in 1993. They just received authorization a year ago. That was a 12-year project. So they can take a long time if you have multiple agency jurisdictions and overlapping. That was an example of a very lengthy permitting project.
Not done yet.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Pat Foley with Pioneer Natural Resources, and I'm here to speak with you first this evening about our Ugarit project. Real quickly, Pioneer is a relative newcomer to the state of Alaska. We've been doing business here in the state for about 3 years. I believe today we have about 26 employees in the state, and we began exploration drilling in 2003. And Ugarit is a development project that is a result of that successful exploration program in 2003.
Which goes forward.
So Ugarit, in the simplest form, is a single offshore drill site which is just off of the Colville Delta. It lies in about 4.5 feet of water, and it involves a single offshore island. There would be no processing on our island. Instead, we have a subsea buried flow line that connects back to existing infrastructure in the Kaparik River Unit, and we're in the ends of negotiations with Kaparik River Unit to utilize their facilities for our processing. Our development is about 15,000 to 20,000 barrels a day at peak, so this is relatively small compared to any of the super fields that you're familiar with. It would be similar to just another drill site within, say, the Kaparik River field. Our idea is that this facility, after the construction and drilling phase, would be unmanned. It would be remotely operated. We'd have the ability through instrumentation to control wells to contain problems immediately, but it would be unmanned. Mm-hmm. The project really has three distinct phases, construction phases. We are on the cusp of receiving all of our federal, state, and North Slope Borough authorizations, and we hope that literally within the next days our project can commence. The idea is that this winter we will install an offshore gravel island. It's about 500,000 cubic yards of gravel, and this island is 6 acres in size. We'll come back next winter and we'll install a subsea buried pipeline bundle, and then that would be followed by a drilling phase of approximately 3 years. This is just a picture of an artist's renditioning of what the offshore island would look like. And again, there's no processing on this island, so different from North Star where they process. This is just a drill site. There's wells, there's manifold, there's storage, and then there's a subsea buried pipeline bundle, and this pipeline would be installed in the winter. We would trench the ice. We dig a trench in the bottom of the seafloor about 8 feet deep. We install the pipeline bundle, cover it up so it's maintained by 6 foot of cover at all times. And then there's a very small gravel expansion next to existing drill site Kaparik 3H, where we would have some other facilities, tankage, instrumentation, and we would connect to Kaparik facilities at that point.
I assume that the reason you're putting in the pipeline bundle before you actually do the drilling is because you're aware that there's already a reservoir there that's been explored and identified before. It's just a matter of how much production there'll be. It will be run through that pipeline bundle. Is that correct?
Exactly, Mr. Chairman. So this was a discovered resource. In fact, the first wells in this were drilled back in the 70s by ARCO, by Texaco, by Amerada Hess. Pioneer found this same reservoir in our 2003 drilling program, and it's just now the oil price allows a project like this to be economic. And this is a picture that depicts our flow line bundle. And again, this is buried underneath the seafloor. And the key to this is there's a production flow line, which I don't have a pointer, but it's the lower left, where oil, gas, and water.
That button, there is a pointer.
So it's this bundle right here.
Yep.
And it's a pipe-in-pipe construction. So three phases, oil, gas, and water, are all shipped from the drill site to existing Kaparik infrastructure. And this pipe has it's a 12-inch steel pipeline with space in between, an annulus, enclosed in another pipeline. So there's two levels of containment. And then this space in between, the annulus, there's a very slight vacuum pulled on this. And this is our leak detection system. And as soon as there's a pressure change, we'll know immediately if we have any kind of a leak from the inside to the out, or from the sea into the outer surface. And we have the ability to shut down wells, shut down production, shut down all our shipping nearly immediately.
Does that produce gas going out or what?
Yes, sir. So there's gas that would come out of existing Kaparik infrastructure. The gas is used for fuel. It's used for gas injection, for reservoir pressure maintenance.
You're producing it and taking it off the drilling
island. In other words, all three phases come off of our island, so they're exported into Kaparik infrastructure. Right. And then water and gas and power will all be imported. They'll be shipped back to our location.
Your whole bundle there is not encased in any way. It just has the spacers, I mean the bundle straps on there holding it together?
That's correct.
As opposed to a casement?
Correct. Early in our design stage, we considered enclosing all of this in a superconductor.
Mm-hmm.
And operationally, it's not feasible.
Mm-hmm.
The weight, the difficulty of installing, it just doesn't make it mm-hmm. practical in this environment.
Okay.
The other unique aspect of our development, again, this is offshore, and all of our wells are drilled in well containment modules. And think of these as steel boxes. Dimensionally, they're 13 feet tall, they're 40 feet in width and 45 feet in length, and all of our wells are drilled inside of them. And this is partially spill containment. There is a sump in the bottom of this facility so that if you had any escaped fluid, it would be contained within the box. It could be pumped into storage tanks, injected back into the reservoir, or injected into our offshore export line. And the idea is that no production, no leak would ever enter the Beaufort Sea.
Mm-hmm.
Pioneer is a relatively new developer on the North Slope, but we're a responsible developer. This is a list of 27 various studies and evaluations that were conducted not as a result of the regulatory process. They're the right things to do. These are things that were considered to make sure that we designed a project that was safe, that was responsible, and that mitigated all of the impacts, whatever they might be, to the best we were able. People ask, what's the cost of a program like this? Pioneer started our permitting for this seriously about 7 months ago, but in reality we began very detailed conversations with the regulatory community back in November of 2004. And since that time, we've incurred nearly $2 million in costs in the regulatory process and along with these studies. Again, it would be unfair to categorize those costs as directly related to the regulatory process. You know, they're the right thing to do, to design a safe and proper project.
Thank you, Pat. I'll just work from right here. Can everybody hear me okay?
Hear you fine, Pat.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, thank you very much. For the record, I'm Mark Major with ConocoPhillips. And we're going to talk about the Alpine Satellite Development Project. Before we go any further, I guess I should ask the committee members, do you know what satellites are? Not the ones up in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. These are smaller oil fields adjacent to another one where you're going to produce that oil into an existing infrastructure. So that's what we're talking about. And that's the logo that we came up with for this project. The reason you have logos and stuff is so you can have nice doodads like this lighted pen.
I don't see the string of pearls on there.
No, but maybe it's in there somewhere behind the caribou or something. All righty, the existing Alpine oil field, this is a winter shot. Alpine is, of course, the first onshore roadless development, commercial production on the North Slope. It's located in the Colville River Delta. It's about 35 miles or so from Dead Horse, Prudhoe Bay area. And it is less than 100 acres development there. What you see in front of you here, this is the CD1 pad, as we call it, Colville Delta 1 pad. The main production pad, production separation facilities and so on are there. Back there in the background is the CD2 pad, Colville Delta number 2. The existing facilities are producing about 115,000 barrels a day, annual average number, with a winter peak up around about 130,000 barrels a day right now. And we are adding on to these with these satellites. The first map shows what was proposed. We had to go through an EIS process to add on these satellite facilities. Just to kind of give you an idea, here is the CD2, CD5, 6, 7 out there. CD3 is there. CD4 is here. So the CD1, CD2 is right in that area, the existing facilities. That was what we proposed. There were a number of changes that were made. You can't really read the writing, but things like the bridge lengths and so on, as we move on and the road layout here, as we move to the next slide, you'll be able to see that these were changed as part of the EIS process. Yeah, good point. There's no exit there. It's about 5 or 6 miles south of the existing facilities. Might also point out the land differences here. This shading that you see right here is land that is privately owned. The land over here is state-owned, so Alpine already has some native corporation involvement,
mm-hmm.
And will continue to, and then out of here is the NPRA, federal land.
Mm-hmm. My understanding is that the gravel that's being extracted for the use of building those pads is coming from New Exic, and you're employing local people to mine and deliver that gravel. Is that correct?
That's much so. We did most of the gravel work last year. We moved about 500,000 cubic yards of gravel, and we couldn't find any residents. We ran out of people in town. Mm. All right, here's what was approved in the EIS process. As I mentioned, several things changed along the way. The bridge across the Niglick Channel was lengthened. We started off with a 1,200-foot bridge. What was approved was 1,650 feet due to a number of concerns there. The routing to get down here to these satellites was changed. A lot of that road was inside of a buffer zone. A lot of that was moved out. The drill site was kept in the buffer, but the road access situation changed dramatically. Some of the other smaller bridges changed. Also, the original proposal had power line poles. Those were taken out. We have to run the power lines on cable trays along the VSMs, vertical support members. And a number of odds and ends features to make it more aesthetically pleasing, less of visual impact, less overall environmental impact.
Mm-hmm.
CD3, this is the one to the north of the existing Alpine facilities. There's the Alpine facilities right there. This will be a roadless development. Once again, there will be no connector road here. I might just stop for a moment. When we say roadless in the oil field, what we mean is not tied back to the infrastructure. That doesn't necessarily mean that you don't have connector roads like we have a connector road from CD1 to CD2. But this one will have its own airstrip, which you see right here, and then the development area with a pipeline coming back down to the Alpine main facilities. Minimum 7-foot high pipelines, that was another factor of the EIS. We had gone in proposing 5-foot high, and the EIS came back with 7. And of course, we'll have spill response equipment pre-staged at various channels along the way for spill response as needed in the future, hopefully never needed. CD4, this one is connected back to the Alpine facilities by a road. This ties in, but once again, we are still not tied to the Kaparik Crudo infrastructure by road. About 3.6 miles of roads connecting back to the CD1, 7-foot high pipelines, about a 10-acre pad, and each of these pads will have about 20 to 25 wells on them. Some of the numbers here related to this, we're going to spend about $500 million developing CD3 and CD4, and that will give us about an extra 20 to 25,000 barrels a day of oil production from those two. Proposed CD5, 6, and 7. Right now we have sanctioned, what we call sanctioning in our company, funded CD3, CD4. CD5, 6, and 7 have not been sanctioned. They have been through the EIS process, but they have not been permitted. We are in the stages of permitting CD5 right now. And work on CD6 and 7 would go on in the future beyond that. You were asking, I think somebody was asking about numbers of permits. I did bring the numbers with me for CD3, CD4. We had 7 federal, 20 state, and 3 local, plus the rezone process. So there was a slew of work. And that's after you've gone through your environmental impact statement.
Mm-hmm.
As Randall kind of touched on, the environmental impact statements, the kind of procedural stuff that gets you to a stage to where you can go get those permits. And these will be a similar situation. This is kind of an artist rendition here of a pad. They'll be about 9 to 10 acres in size. They'll have 7-foot high pipelines, and all the fluids go back to Alpine. I'm going to turn it over to Randall now to talk about Liberty.
Question here. Mr. Major, looking back in your other chart here, the cross-hatched route here, is that the proposed roadway? So you
yes.
go all the way out to CD7 would be, you would build a gravel road?
That is the current development plan.
Right, and down to CD4, okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll visit with you briefly about BP's newest development project, and that's the Liberty project. It is an offshore development project. It's 100 to 150 million barrel recoverable reserves on federal leases out in the Outer Continental Shelf. The project went through an environmental impact statement process from 1998 to 2002. Several months prior to receiving the final environmental impact statement and draft permits, BP decided to hold off on the project. They were having, at that point in time, it's the same North Star project was just being challenged. There were 20 pieces of litigation filed against North Star, so the company decided to get through litigating one project before going to another offshore project. Since that time, BP has completely redesigned the project. For 2 years, they looked at developing something that would have been similar in design and that Mr. Foley went through, with an offshore island with no processing, but taking three phase back to either Endicott or Badami. And then just in the last year, because of developments worldwide with extended reach drilling or long reach directional drilling, miles out into the offshore in both the United Kingdom and on the North Slope, the company rethought the process, and for the last 9 months has had basically what will be an onshore single drill pad that will access the offshore leases. It'll be the first of its kind on the North Slope, and in fact, probably in the United States. MMS's regulations really weren't written to allow you to drill 5 to 7 miles out to access them. So we're working through some jurisdictional issues with them right now. The current design has us evaluating. Tomorrow morning we will sign a memorandum of understanding. I just finished drafting with the Corps of Engineers, the Minerals Management Service and BP, and we anticipate the state of Alaska signing on to that in the next month to begin to supplement that original EIS. We're going to evaluate two different drill sites, one closer to Endicott, this is Endicott, and then Badami and Prudhoe is back in here. There is no road going out to Badami. There isn't a road out to the Endicott Causeway. We're looking at a drill site closer to Badami, down in here, and then one closer to Endicott. Our current base case has us developing the Point Brower well site, drilling this 5.4 miles. One of the wells will actually be, or several of them will be in 8 miles out. I have a good drawing of that, with production going back to BP's 100% on Badami field, which is now back up in operation, and then producing the fluids at Badami and then going back out to the Badami pipeline down into town.
Mr. Chairman, Endicott, what's the who owns Endicott?
The ownership of Endicott, it is largely ExxonMobil and BP with a few other minority interests.
I couldn't use their facilities.
That's also under evaluation. Just the background, the Liberty appraisal well was in 1997, the same year that ARCO at that time was doing the final permitting of Alpine. The original concept, as I mentioned, was a twin to North Star. That's just a pictorial of the entire North Slope. Project status now, we're going to spend 2006 going through what we call the select phase, or the final conceptual level engineering, tightener alternatives, the selection of the development option, the design basis, and putting together our permitting plan. We're going through an extensive pre-application process. And then the end of the year, late December, we will hand a draft development plan to the Minerals Management Service and the Corps of Engineers. And then in the second quarter of 2007, we'll start the supplemental EIS process. The base case is 10 to 15 production and injection wells, as I mentioned, back to Badami with the three baseline. We are trying to permit it as, we're evaluating it as roadless, but the base case has a road because of the extensive drilling program. It is a world-class extended reach drilling program. We do believe we need a road to the facility. This is a pictorial for those from Anchorage, just to get a good estimate of how far out we'll be going. If you stuck the drill rig down in Ship Creek, you would be shooting at basically a target that's 2 miles deep down in the Seward Highway and Huffman area, so down by Huffman Cars. We calculated it in Juno terms, and that's like drilling from this building out to the abandoned Kmart out in Lemon Creek. It truly is world class, and we're excited about it. Our drilling folks are from all over the world are trying to get here because it will move current technology to where it hasn't gone before. That's another example of it. We will have both producing wells and injector wells going out into the Liberty Reservoir 8 miles out and well beyond the current envelope of technology. That's three projects that went through a very lengthy permitting process. Although, Pat, I guess it'll be about a year by the time you're finally done. To go through Liberty, we're just now finishing the process. We estimate about 2.5 years from this point in time to final permits, 2.5 to 3 years. And a lot of that is because of the tripartite, the federal, state, local issues that you have to address anywhere in the state of Alaska, just about, because of the wetlands permitting. And very few states, there is ability by a state to assume primacy of wetlands permitting from the Corps of Engineers. Only 4 to 5 states have done that. It's a very difficult process. But because of the extensive jurisdiction of the Corps of Engineers in Alaska, anytime you want to develop in a wetlands, it pushes you into that NEPA, the Environmental Impact Statement or Environmental Assessment process. Is it a significant federal action? Basically developing, laying gravel anywhere is evaluated by, considered some folks as significant. If it is looked at as being significant, that pushes you into the EIS process, OCS, civil works, bridges, wastewater discharges, endangered species. There are a number of petitions almost yearly to try and list more species in the state or on the North Slope as endangered or threatened, or to petition the federal government to set aside critical habitat for those. And we're constantly monitoring those lawsuits by national and worldwide environmental groups to make the process even more difficult. The National Marine Fisheries, polar bears, there's currently a lawsuit right now on the polar bears to look at the habitat for those, fuel storage. This is just, because we're going through this right now for Liberty, it provided a good example of the analysis that has to go in up front to look at it. And as Pat mentioned, we've been doing studies for years. We'll do a lot more over the next year to tighten the design. And that's the critical part, is to do the studies up front so that in your design work, you build it and you build it right. And you build it in an environmentally friendly manner. And I think we do that very well in Alaska, and we do it very well on the North Slope. Before we move to the closing questions, as Judy mentioned, we just want to reiterate that, you know, the Title 19 Land Management Regulation through the North Slope Borough, that every local borough or city just about in the state has the authority to try and assume Title 19 or to draft coastal management policies. And the next 6 to 9 months will be very busy, both in the State Department of Natural Resources, because they're not just reviewing the Kenai Peninsula Borough or the Northwest Arctic Borough. They're reviewing every set of local policies. They're going to be very busy, and it's going to be an interesting 6 to 9 months as we move through the process.
That was part of the mandate from HB 191 to have all coastal districts resubmit new plans to come in conformance with regulatory requirements.
Mr. Chairman and yes. Members of the committee, now we'll go through these questions. It will be another 10 minutes here. That's
okay.
All right. And any of you can answer the first question.
All
about
right.
How long does it take?
I'll start off. I guess a lot depends on the project, where it is. There's a lot of variables there. Generally, you're looking for any kind of major project for a 3 to 4 year time frame. That's a good ballpark number, but I think Pioneer has probably broken the records here with some of their activities for Ugaruk. They're probably, what, 2 years you're looked at?
14 months.
Yeah, right. obviously, if you have to do an environmental impact statement, you can almost plan on certainly a 2 year process. The quickest EIS that's been done for an oil and gas development was the Alpine Satellite EIS. That was an 18-month process. So if you've got something big, that's what you're looking at. 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years on some. Mm-hmm. I think North Star probably was the longest process in the EIS phase. That was what?
Yeah, the North Star EIS took about 4 years.
About 4 years, right.
If controversy arises during the planning and you don't address it, it just extends it. And that is one reason BP started to evaluate Liberty from onshore. It takes away a lot of the controversy by coming onshore in that area. The Liberty Prospect is fairly close to Cross Island, which is a major whaling area for the North Slope Borough. So we hope that by, you know, we involve the North Slope Borough residents in, you know, the decision making and evaluation, and we're gaining their support by coming onshore.
The movement of habitat out of fish and game into DNR makes a big difference because there used to be people in that department that would deadlock mm-hmm. agency work on projects, and that still happens in some of the federal agencies. They just go into deadlock, mm-hmm. and it takes an enormous amount of time then to work around that.
Keep in mind, too, that when we're talking, you've got to do your EIS first before you can go yeah. apply for your permits.
Right.
So there's that built-in process, and that kind of leads into number two. Mm-hmm. How much does it cost? Once again, considering all the variables, you got to go get that baseline data
right.
if it's a real complicated or controversial project. So you might have 2 or 3 years' worth of baseline studies before you even start your EIS process.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty pricey.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you a little color from an independence perspective. You know, for projects to be economic, one of the big drivers here is cycle time. And typically, North Slope Development Project from discovery to production would be on the order of 7 to 10 years or longer. And when an independent from the lower 48 looks at coming to Alaska, they are just appalled by those times. These are companies that are used to finding something mm-hmm. tomorrow and having it sold down a pipeline in 6 months. Just a little bit of color. How long this would be from an independent perspective, considering doing business in the state of Alaska. You know, how long does it take to permit a project? Longer than you could possibly imagine is the answer. How much does it cost? More than you possibly could imagine. You know, is it a transparent permitting system? Yes. but it'll take you many, many months to figure out what it is. Who should I talk to? Everybody. What permits do I need? That's a really good question. You know,
And more than once, talk to everybody, that's for sure.
Yes. You know, what permits do I need? Company like mine, we don't have the luxury of having, you know, giant regulatory staffs. Agurek was done basically by four people and, you know, really long hours and for about 14 months. And we are on the cusp of getting all of our regulatory approvals. And just the other day, we all sat in a room and said, here's what we have. Is that really what we need? Is there anything else? And I got three blank stares back from them. What permits do we need? Mm-hmm. It's a challenge.
For those very reasons that you just articulated here is why I keep reiterating over and over, any recommendations you have as to how we can streamline that process, we're open to that, or I'm open to that. So please don't hesitate to bring it to our attention. If these lower 48 operators are appalled at how Alaska operates, well, that says perhaps the system should be changed. As far as I'm concerned, so long as it's not compromising safety and the environment, let's make some changes, streamline it. So you let us know. You're the experts.
Yep, you know,
in general,
the Alaska, it's a world-class petroleum system, and the people that do business here are world-class operators, and it is by far environmentally the most responsible development anywhere on the planet. And to accomplish that, it takes time and people and money.
Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, we might want to think about an ombudsman for the permitting process, or the paratroopers call them pathfinders, I think, something like that. Before you drop into an area, send pathfinders in there first to help independents come in to the permitting process. But
mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, that's what Mr. Foley does.
I know, it's a pathfinder.
That's what we all do a little bit of.
I was curious, one thing we did, going back to the creation of the area-wide leasing concept, was the idea of having baseline data available in the best interest finding and then extending the life of the best interest finding. Mm-hmm. Seems to me, I think Mr. Major brought up the idea of having to wait until you get EIS and then gather baseline data. Is there not a repository, is it proprietary, where you can't we reuse or have existing data? We've had, I mean, not the North Slope area, it's got to be one of, like you've already indicated, one of the most studied areas in the world. I mean, I don't understand why some of that can't be, or could it be, if we even legislatively gave permission or something, or anointed some of this data for baseline. I mean, is there any discussions like along those lines? Or?
Yeah, Representative Roper, through the chair, you're kind of my straight man. When Pioneer began this work, we talked with all of the companies, and it was at that time the opinion that a project like Ugarit would probably require an EIS. And that we took great exception to that, because we said there have been a number of EISs conducted in this area. The same questions have been asked. The same decisions were ultimately made and documented. Can't we just rely upon that body of knowledge? And the answer is, I think, yes, we have been able to do that. And because of that, our project, I believe in the next week, will be approved by an EA. And because we have relied upon this mountain of study and documentation that exists on the slope. Now, you get outside of the Colville Canyon, you know, right in the backyard of oil development, it's different.
And there is a large volume of data that is out there, and we're constantly building upon it.
Mr. Chair, I was just mm-hmm. going to kind of reiterate on that. There's a lot of data in certain areas, but as you move into a new area, you have to have focused studies on that area. You want to know where the birds nest in that area, what species are there, which lakes have fish, which ones don't. Some areas you have a lot of data, some you have limited data. To the degree we can, we do share that data with other operators, and it is available through agencies, Fish and Wildlife Service, Fish and Game, Department of Natural Resources, and so on. But as you step out away from infrastructure, you get into a tougher and tougher situation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, Representative Roper.
I was going to compliment Mr. Foley. It's probably closest to the pronunciation of the name of the project that I've had for my many years in Alaska. But I'm surprised there's not a permit in Inuit language or Inupiat to make sure you're pronouncing these words correctly. Just joking.
If you'll indulge me in a short humorous story, Ugric is a bearded seal.
Right.
And this was a name we inherited from a company that put this project together. And we kind of questioned its spelling with three O's, but they assured us that this was the correct ancient spelling for the word Ugric. And I fell into this hook, line, and sinker. I was in the village of Nooksit. And so they said, you know, we've never seen it spelled that way with three O's. kind of caught me back. And I said, well, it's the ancient spelling. And they all laughed. And they took me aside afterwards and they said, up until very recently, we didn't have a written language. There is no such thing as an ancient spelling.
Well, I appreciate the representative's efforts at being humorous, but I would ask that he please keep his day job.
How subjective is the permit system? I think we've talked on some of the, it's fairly transparent. Subjective, I wouldn't say, I think the rules are laid out. I think you know what your path has to be. I think the subjectivity sometimes comes in on, is there enough information? Do you really have enough studies to make the call? And that's always a tough one. Major issues driving permit approvals. From our perspective, obviously, we have time. We have a limited operating season. We can operate and do our major construction. Generally, it's better to do it in the winter than it is the summer. You can add a little gravel to an existing pad that's on a road system in the summer. But for projects like the Alpine Satellites, for like Brook and Liberty Gravel Placement, all that stuff's got to be done in the winter. So you've got a limited window, and you always run up against that window and getting your approvals in time enough to get work done this winter. Otherwise, basically, you lose a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly one of the major issues that drives all of our approvals. Is the timing of it. And can we get it in time to do it this year? Because if you don't, it's not like down south, okay, if you get it 2 weeks later, okay, you just start 2 weeks later. Well, here, that 2 weeks or a month could basically throw you to where you are going to get it all done that winter, and that means a delay of a year in starting up that project, which is obviously you got a lot of money on the table sitting there doing nothing for you.
Mark, is that limited window that you speak of, is that closing in light of the weather changes and what we keep reading about in the papers of permafrost melting and so forth? Is that having an effect on
Mr. Chair, actually, we've had some real strides in that area. The process that was used for winter tundra travel on the North Slope was an on and off switch. Today, I can't take any big equipment out there. Tomorrow, I can take cats, bulldozers, cranes, whatever I want out there. Well, what we're moving to now is a more of a system that reflects on what equipment you're going to be using, what time frames, and so on. And we've brought a lot more science into it. The equipment that was used by the state to determine when tundra travel was suitable was a slide hammer, a cone penetrometer that they use for highways. Well, it's a tool, and it does give you some information, but you operating that would be different than me, would be different than Randall, would be different than Judy. So now we've gone to more of a scientific methodology where we're using ground temperatures and so on and so forth. The BLM and the federal lands, they've always worked with industry and used cone penetrometers on the back of rollergons where you can measure it. They've also used weather stations that were installed out there to tell frost depths and temperatures and so on. So I think we're actually seeing some improvements in that area, and I think last winter was the first sign of it, where we had a little longer tundra travel season than before. And I think we're going to continue to see that over the future, putting science to use. Hey, you have all this technology and science, why not use it?
Mm-hmm.
And we're still protecting the environment.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, I know we said that we would be short, so maybe have each one close with however you want to close, just in a minute.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, it is a pleasure to be back here with you. I've had the privilege of working with you and your staff on a number of pieces of legislation over the years, including this subject. And from my perspective, you know, having worked in the mining industry, the timber industry, and the oil and gas industry now for four different companies, it is complex. but it's complex because this is a big state with a lot of federal land, and the federal environmental legal structure is extremely complex. You know, federal air permitting, which dictates the state of Alaska's permitting, is the most complex in the world. The regulations, you know, are now numbered. I'm reviewing a set of regulations that's numbered quadruple N, you know, tens of thousands of pages. So it is complex. Is it broken? There have been some tweaks over the years, but from my perspective, the state part of that triangle is working pretty well. And compared to maybe 5 years ago, it's working very well. The changes from HB 191, you know, to date have been effective. We still have some work to do there because we don't have local policies yet. And largely what comes out is going to be dependent upon those local policies. But it is complex, but I think we do it very well.
Thank you.
Yeah, real quickly, on Ugarit, I would mimic what Randall said. I think the state's process works relatively well. As an example, on our on Ugarit, we started all of our North Slope state and federal permits at the same time. All of the state authorizations under ACMP, nearly everything I needed from DNR, from DEC, and from the Land and Water Group in Fairbanks, we had by October of last year. And North Slope Borough lagged 4 months behind, and I'm still waiting on the Corps on the federal side. So,
thank you. Mark?
Certainly, I would agree with everything that's been said there. A couple things I would like to add. When you get into a major project where there is a lot of state involvement, one thing that we found that was real beneficial was having a state coordinator designated for that project. For example, for the Alpine satellites, it was Ken Taylor. And that helped kind of corral, make sure everybody was on the same page within the state, and helped kept things moving along so you didn't have these last-minute deadlocks, gridlocks, battles. Kind of kept some consistency to the process and kept it moving along. So that's one recommendation I would certainly encourage as you get into a big project, is to have someone to be a state coordinator. The federal process is the one that's lagging. The state process, is it perfect? No. Works pretty good. It's probably a little more complicated, but I think before we make any changes at this stage, let us kind of get through some of the things that are already in the works. For example, like the ABC list work that's going to be going on, the district enforceable policies and all that. And I think we'll be in a better position to assess that maybe this time next year. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank
you
very much. We appreciate the time that you for listening to us. This is very important to the companies up here to be able to get through the permitting. And as we come up with ideas about how to make it, improve it, we'll certainly be talking to all of you about next steps.
All right. Yeah. And thank you very much for your presentation. Really appreciate it. Mr. Buchendorf and Foley and Mark Major and Judy, really appreciate you taking time to join us here in Juneau. Thank you also for your presentation over lunch and for inviting us there. It was good to see you again. And again, my offer is open if there's any suggestions that you guys have as far as what we can look at as a committee, as a legislature, to streamline the permitting process to make it easier for the industry to operate. We're certainly open to that, or at least I am. I'd like to leave that as my final comments. And again, thank you very much for taking time to come down here. We look forward to working with you for the duration of the session and years to come, hopefully, for those of us that have aspirations to run again. And with that, I'd like to see if there's any further comments by the committee before we wrap this thing up. Seeing none, I'd like to announce that our next committee is not determined yet as far as our meeting, so it's just TBA to be announced at this point. It'll likely be sometime shortly after the 10th of February. So I'd like to close this meeting at 7:21. Thank you very much, everybody.